From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and I am broadcasting from London today, where there are a lot of Brexit politics going on this week, and we will get to that. But we're going to start this hour in Washington,
where, as you know, Jeremy, two career diplomats are testifying behind closed doors today in the House impeachment inquiry about how outsiders loyal to President Trump tried to influence Ukraine policy. Tomorrow, the House holds its first formal vote on rules for going forward with its inquiry. And Jeremy, before we get to our Wednesday strategist, I just wonder, in London, are they talking about the inquiry that's going on here in the U.S.?
Well, as you know, they have their own politics to deal with right now. But I will say that now that they've decided they're going to have an election coming up in December, the BBC News This Hour led with the Trump impeachment story. So, yes, they are talking about it.
How about that? Well, let's get to our political strategist. Alice Stewart is a Republican. She joins me in the studio. Bill Press, a Democrat. Hi to you both.
Hi, Robin.
Hello. Hello. Hi, Robin.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Alice.
And Alice, let me start with you, because as you look to this vote tomorrow going on in the House of Representatives, what do you think the significance of that is? Republicans have been asking for this and Democrats are giving it to them.
Sure. This is a classic case of be careful what you wish for because you might get it. And I do think it's important that we move from closed door depositions to open hearings in order for all of Americans, Republicans and Democrats, to go through this with full transparency. The question I have is based on the rule bill that has been put forth. So much of the calling forth of witnesses and subpoenaing different people involved in this is all in the hands of the Democrats, all at the subject of approval of the chair. And the White House can call witnesses, but it all is subject to the approval of the chair. And it will be very preferential to the Democrats, but that's the benefit of being in control. You have mm-hmm. that power. But if this is a little more balanced in regards to Republicans being able to have more equal access to calling witnesses and putting forth testimony, that will be more beneficial. But this is the elections have consequences, and Democrats will be in full control of this.
Bill, do you think that all the Democrats are going to be in line with the leadership on this vote and say, yes, they want to move forward with this?
I think there will definitely be enough Democrats to move forward, maybe not every single last one. I also want to point out, I'm so tired of this argument about, oh, things were happening behind closed doors. If you look at the Hill, and I was there yesterday at a hearing, almost every investigative hearing starts, the Nixon impeachment did, the Clinton impeachment did, all of them, with, and other issues, with closed-door hearings to find out what witnesses might want to say, and then they have public hearings. That's standard procedure. We learned about the Nixon tapes from Alexander Butterfield behind closed doors before it was ever public, number one. Number two, Alice is right on this one. Yeah, you know, Republicans can't whine that Democrats are making the rules. Democrats, guess what? They're in charge, and they get to make the rules. From what I've seen so far, Jeremy and Robin, of the rules, that I think they're very fair. They provide equal time for Republicans and Democrats to question the witnesses and present whatever documents or testimony they want. These are the rules for moving forward. But I think the significant thing is that this means this process is going to the next step, which is a formal impeachment inquiry in public.
Well, and the Democrats have been promising that. The Republicans have been protesting that it isn't in public right now, but we know a lot has been leaking out. Bill, it sounds like one of the things Alice was saying there, that Republicans, Democrats are in charge, and that means Democrats will also own this, you know, which, you know, we know how Republicans fared in midterm elections after Bill Clinton was impeached. But I want to ask you, Alice, if you're worrying about some of the things that are coming out from not just the, you know, leaked from the closed door testimony, but from statements. On NPR's Morning Edition, the Republican Congressman Scott Perry confirmed this morning that in testimony yesterday from National Security staffer Alexander Vindman, Vindman tried to restore at least two parts of President Trump's July 25th phone call with that Ukrainian president that had been omitted from the transcript we've seen of the call. Now, the New York Times reports the omissions were references to Joe Biden and his son's business dealings in Ukraine. Today, the Ohio Congressman Jim Jordan downplayed this. Let's listen.
The changes, I think, that were outlined in the press were not a big deal, if in fact that was the case. So it didn't concern me. I don't think concerned anyone that's engaged in that process.
Not a big deal. Didn't concern me. But Alice, there may have been more damning evidence on that transcript of Trump referring to a political rival. This is what we're hearing. And in any event, the opening statements in these hearings are pretty damning enough. At a certain point, as we're hearing, there will be open hearings. Are you nervous?
The testimony we heard from Vindman is concerning. Also, what we heard from Taylor is concerning. Look, I have said from the very beginning the phone call was inappropriate. It was ill-advised. As to at the time, as what we currently have, is it worthy of impeachment? That remains to be seen based on what we've heard. But for Vindman to come out and say that the transcript doesn't accurately represent the phone call, that's a concern. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the White House disagrees. I'm not worried about the words on the page. What I am worried are the ellipses and the dot, dot, dot. Mm-hmm. What exactly was said during that period? We're going to get to the bottom of this. The whistleblower was obviously relying his information on second and third hand accounts. But now
some
we have
Vindman.
Right. And now we have Vindman who actually heard the call. And I think this is critical information. And it certainly does lend itself to further investigation and cause for concern.
Yeah. Jeremy?
Yeah, some high-profile conservatives, I want to ask you this, Bill, questioned Vindman's loyalties. He is, of course, a 20-year decorated military officer who was born in Ukraine. Here's Fox News host Laura Ingraham speaking on Monday night.
Here we have a U.S. national security official who is advising Ukraine while working inside the White House, apparently against the president's interest, and usually they spoke in English. Isn't that kind of an interesting angle on this story?
And then here is the Republican conference chair, Congresswoman Liz Cheney, who didn't like that kind of attack.
We're talking about decorated veterans who have served this nation, who have put their lives on the line, and it is shameful to question their patriotism, their love of this nation, and we should not be involved in that process.
So Liz Cheney, not in favor of what Laura Ingraham was doing there. But Bill, how much of a problem is it for this impeachment inquiry that many Republicans will listen to Laura Ingraham and not Liz Cheney on something like this and all of the attacks on the people who are testifying?
Well, even though I've been involved in politics a long time, I still have faith in the political system and faith in elected leaders. And I believe that this is seen as shameful and disgusting by most Republicans. Look, he is a Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, as you pointed out, is a 20-year veteran of the Army. Yes, he's an immigrant. He's a loyal patriot. He got the Purple Heart. He works in the White House and the National Security Council. For the president to go after him and his followers to go after him, I think, is beyond contempt. It reminds me of what they did to a real American hero, another one, John McCain. I think it's disgusting, and I think everybody should repudiate that. But I just want to mention, I think one of the most significant things that happened this week is the president himself said to his Republican supporters on the Hill, stop talking about process, start talking about substance. And I think that is a very tricky road and slippery slope for Republicans, because that means he wants them to stand up and say, yes, it's okay to withhold military aid in exchange for political dirt. I really want to hear them try to defend that. And that's where the president wants to take it next.
I'm going to ask Alice about that. But Bill and Jeremy, I have to tell you both, when you were playing Laura Ingraham, Alice was sitting here shaking her head. I mean, obviously, you don't think that's a good road to hoe, making these diplomats who have worked for both parties, who are such patriots. This man is carrying shrapnel to somehow question his patriotism.
Yeah. Two words jump out at me when I heard Laura Ingraham say that and others.
Are we going to need to bleep these words, Alice?
The two words are Purple Heart. This is a Purple Heart recipient, and people are questioning his patriotism. There's really no place for that.
But baby, in the time we have, I do want to ask you, Alice, what Bill asked. Do you think the Republicans can make the case that it's okay for the president to have made this phone call and asked another country to investigate a political rival who all reports at the time said he was just doing the business of the American government? And then maybe there was even a quid pro quo that make the case that it was okay to withhold aid. Do you think that's going to work?
That's what this whole process is about. And really, that's the only case that they can make as we hear more information about it. Look, many will acknowledge that it was inappropriate, but they do not see that it rises to the level of impeachment. And I am glad we are getting back to the point where we're focusing on substance, because if they do truly feel nothing is is wrong, I don't think this, as we know now, it's impeachable, then let's focus on the substance. Let's not focus on the process. And because it is common practice and common strategy, when you have the facts, you pound the facts into the table. When you have the law, you pound the law. When you don't have the facts or the law, you pound the table. Mm-hmm. And that's not going to help Republicans. We need to focus on the substance. We need to focus on whether or not this was inappropriate and worthy of impeachment. I don't think it is, but that's the whole process of what we need to get to the bottom.
And I want to add quickly, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman and Bill Taylor have both given us the facts. So, yes, Alice, let's deal with the facts and move forward.
That is Bill Press, a Democrat and host of the Bill Press podcast, and Alice Stewart, Republican strategist, currently a fellow at the Harvard Institute of Politics. Sorry we don't have time for 2020 today, but we will maybe get there next week, although who knows? Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Thank you.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
I'm in London this week where British Prime Minister Boris Johnson says he expects a tough campaign in the United Kingdom's first December election since 1923. Last night, the House of Commons approved Johnson's request for the early poll after years of deadlock over Brexit. The UK was scheduled to leave the European Union tomorrow, but the EU this week granted the UK an extension until January 31st, 2020. We've been speaking with members of Parliament, and joining us now is Mike Wood, a Conservative Party member of Parliament who supports Brexit. Welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, Jeremy.
And is your message to voters now, vote for the Conservative Party and we will deliver Brexit?
That's exactly the message. Right? 3.5 years ago, we had largest democratic exercise the UK has ever seen. More people voted for Brexit in that referendum than have ever voted for a political party in an election. And frankly, my constituents want to know why 3.5 years later, we still haven't left. We still haven't done what we were told. We haven't carried out that instruction. And this election is a chance to make sure that, firstly, Boris Johnson and the government can do it, but also there is a clear instruction, clear mandate to make sure they do it.
Are you worried, though, that this is a gamble for your cause, that the results might not make it any easier to take the UK out of the EU?
Any election is a gamble, but you also have to look at what's the alternative. And Parliament's been deadlocked for so long, there's a fundamental mismatch between a country that voted to leave and a House of Commons that is dominated by Remain-supporting members of Parliament who were really wanting to use any excuse to block any type of Brexit that most of our voters would recognise. And so actually I think that going for an election, allowing the people again to make the decision themselves, decide what they want Parliament to look like, decide what they want to Brexit, is much less of a gamble than, you know, staggering on as we are with the kind of deadlock that we've seen in Parliament in recent months, which could only lead to further decline in trust in politics and, of course, the economic damage that comes with further uncertainty and delay.
But as you know, even your own party is split on this issue. Not everybody in the Conservative Party is in favor of Brexiting at this point.
Not everybody in the Conservative Party was in favor of Brexit in the referendum. I mean, it was something that went across party lines. That's one of the reasons why we had the referendum rather than it being decided in the usual way through a general election. But pretty much all Conservative MPs now actually respect the decision that was taken. They have voted for Boris Johnson's deal with the European Union earlier this month. And actually, we'll be going into this election with a very clear message that there is a deal that's been secured. We think this is the best way of fulfilling the instruction voters gave us. And to do that, we need the numbers in Parliament to make sure that we can get it through.
If Labour is able to take control after this election, would you say that's the end of the road for Brexit, or you think Brexit could still happen?
No, I don't think Brexit would happen. If Jeremy Corbyn's in Downing Street, it's likely that it would be a minority or coalition government propped up by the Liberal Democrats, who are obviously in favour of revoking Brexit altogether, propped up by the Scottish Nationalists, who want to block Brexit and want a second referendum on the breakup of the United Kingdom. So I think Brexit would be completely off the table if Jeremy Corbyn was in Downing Street after 12th of December.
Would you say that the idea of a no-deal Brexit is still out there if you can't get Boris Johnson's deal through Parliament, even if you win another election here?
Well, I mean, obviously, no deal is theoretically possible, but the Prime Minister is absolutely committed and he's got the support of the Conservative Party, I think both inside Parliament and outside of Parliament around the country, to get backing for that deal. So I think the two alternatives that we're looking at in this election is either Boris Johnson is back as Prime Minister, in which case we'll be trying to get his deal through Parliament, or if Jeremy Corbyn is heading up a ragtag government of, I say, various extreme left people who've never accepted the referendum and people who want to break up the United Kingdom, in which case Brexit will just be cancelled altogether.
Mike Wood, what do you say to critics who believe that Brexit will hurt the economy in the UK, hurt Britain's standing in the world, and weaken the EU as countries like Russia and China gain power?
I spent 7 years working in the European Parliament. I'm not anti-European. I see a lot of benefits of European Union, but I also saw a lot of the frustrations, a lot of the ways in which it held our country back. And so what I would say is we need to have more faith and more confidence in the abilities of our people and in the abilities of our companies and of our country as a whole, that actually once we're moving beyond membership of the European Union, we're a more outward-looking country that's facing out to the whole world rather than just a small part of Western Europe. We can trade and cooperate with Europe, of course we can, but we also need to be stepping up our closer cooperation with all parts of the world economically, as in terms of security and defence. And I think that's actually more fitting for the role that UK has played in the past and actually what we have to offer the world in the future.
That is Conservative Party MP Mike Wood joining us from Westminster. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And now a closer look at telemedicine, seeing a doctor by video conference. You may already know it's becoming more common. In fact, the American Hospital Association reports that 75% of U.S. hospitals are connecting patients and health practitioners remotely using video and other technologies. The growth of telemedicine could be a solution to healthcare problems like long wait times, lack of access in rural areas, and workforce shortages. But there are still questions about whether telemedicine will be able to deliver. Jason Moon of New Hampshire Public Radio reports.
If you know which hallway to walk down at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center, one of New Hampshire's largest hospitals, you can enter into a space that's kind of bizarre. It's a hospital within the hospital. Dartmouth-Hitchcock calls it the Telehealth Center. Inside, it has its own emergency department, psychiatry unit, pharmacy, all of them delivering that care to people miles away. In one corner, Mark Franklin, a critical care doctor, stands at a desk with 8 screens.
Right now on here, there's about 40 patients that I'm monitoring right now.
Franklin says he gets all the same info from these screens that he would if he were there at those hospitals in person. Patients' medical histories, their vital signs in real time. And he can also use cameras and microphones to speak with the patients and doctors on site.
Just before I was talking to you, they had asked me to camera in and talk to family about how the patient's doing. So it's a two-way communication system that we have.
Franklin also works with patients in person at Dartmouth-Hitchcock's ICU. He says learning how to do the same work remotely took some getting used to, but he says ultimately he makes the same decisions and delivers the same care. Now, telemedicine is becoming a bigger and bigger part of what major hospitals, including Dartmouth-Hitchcock, do these days. When it launched the Telemedicine Center in 2012, the concept was still something of a novelty. That first year, Dartmouth-Hitchcock did less than 100 video encounters with patients. By last year, the hospital was doing more than 4,500.
It is a very significant part of our overall rural health strategy.
Dr. Kevin Curtis oversees telemedicine at Dartmouth-Hitchcock. He says Dartmouth-Hitchcock is responsible for a huge swath of both New Hampshire and Vermont, hundreds of thousands of lives.
Most of those lives live rurally, and many of them are at a distance.
Rural clinics have a hard time hiring positions like stroke specialists. Now they can pay Dartmouth-Hitchcock to provide one via video call on demand if a stroke patient comes through the door. And it's not only big hospitals that are moving in this direction.
Katie, can you open your mouth, stick out your tongue, and say, ah? And you can see you've got a really nice view of the back of her throat.
Dr. Kristen Johnson is a pediatrician in Exeter, New Hampshire. She's launching what she believes is the state's first ever telemedicine program for school children. Starting next school year, students who come into the school nurse's office at Newfields Elementary can receive examinations from Johnson remotely. Using a tablet computer with special attachments, the school nurse can look in kids' ears, measure their heart rates, and take their blood pressure. The images and audio are live streamed to Johnson, who can diagnose things like ear infections and prescribe for them without ever leaving her office.
I'm really excited about this. I think that this has the opportunity to really expand across multiple schools and become a much bigger part of what we do.
But as telemedicine grows, some warn we should be paying attention to how it's used.
If it was something like stroke or a patient with serious mental illness, I'm on a chair applauding.
Dr. Ativ Mehrotra researches telemedicine at Harvard Medical School.
However, if we said more people with bronchitis are getting visits, then I'm not so sure that's a good thing.
Mehrotra's research has shown that the biggest growth in telemedicine is happening in direct-to-consumer telemedicine. Think FaceTiming your doctor from home. And what's more, he says, is that most of these new televisits are new patients. In other words, they aren't replacing in-person doctor's appointments, they're adding to them. And that undercuts the idea that telemedicine will be able to fix the country's shortage of healthcare workers.
Telemedicine allows people in urban areas to go take care of rural patients, but it doesn't address the issue that there just isn't enough time of the doctors.
Then there's the question of whether these changes are good for patients. Some studies have shown that connecting specialists between different hospitals can lead to health outcomes that are just as good or even better than if they were there in person. But other studies of direct-to-consumer telemedicine have suggested it can lead to over-testing of patients and over-prescribing of medications. As telemedicine continues to expand, patients and providers will have to decide when this technology makes people healthier and when it's just convenient. For Here and Now, I'm Jason Moon.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The CEO of Boeing is back on Capitol Hill today for another grilling from lawmakers about those two fatal crashes of the company's 737 MAX airplane. Dennis Muhlenberg testified yesterday before the Senate Commerce Committee. In his opening statement, he addressed the victims' families, many of whom were in attendance, saying he thinks about them and their loved ones every day.
I know that probably doesn't offer much comfort and healing at this point, but I want you to know that we carry those memories with us every day. And every day, that drives us to improve the safety of our airplanes and our industry.
Well, he was right on one point, and that is that it didn't offer much comfort. The hearing took place on the anniversary of the first crash, Lion Air Flight 610, which plunged into the Java Sea minutes after takeoff, killing all 189 people aboard. Less than 5 months later, Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302 crashed en route from Addis Ababa to Nairobi, killing 157 people. And what was underscored in the hearing, again, is that Boeing had information that the plane was flawed. Let's bring in Here and Now Transportation Analyst Seth Kaplan. Seth, did we learn anything new in those hearings about how those planes were flawed?
Not really. Boeing has changed the things it said publicly in nuanced ways since the early days. Early on, they tried to place more blame on the pilots. Now they've accepted more public responsibility for this. But in terms of what went wrong and what brought down the planes, no new key information during the hearings.
Well, we did hear again about that instant message from 2016, an exchange between two pilots that describes egregious errors in the onboard flight control system known as MCAS that was discovered during the simulator test of the MAX airplane. It was discovered that the pilot could not override the system, which would point the nose down. Here's Senator Richard Blumenthal, the Democrat of Connecticut.
Those pilots never had a chance. These loved ones never had a chance. They were in flying coffins as a result of Boeing deciding that it was going to conceal MCAS from the pilots.
And as we have reported on, you know, Boeing did not brief pilots early on possible problems with the MCAS, despite obviously pilots who were testing it and simulators knowing about that in 2016. Did they offer any other reasoning for that?
The idea with MCAS, Robin, was that this was supposed to make the MAX fly just like the old plane. So that was the whole thought process here, that, you know, once they did work it out, that an airline pilot flying it shouldn't notice anything. So in Boeing's mind, apparently, you know, why complicate things? We now know that very clearly there were key differences with these aircraft and the fact that pilots didn't know of the existence of MCAS in the case of the Lion Air crash, and then that they couldn't overcome it in the case of the Ethiopian crash was very much a big factor in both of those crashes.
Boeing is facing dozens of lawsuits over these crashes, including from victims' families. They fired the head of the unit that makes the 737 MAX. Is it thought anyone else will be held accountable?
Yeah, that was Kevin McAllister, the head of Boeing's commercial aircraft division. Boeing, you know, basically two sides to Boeing, the military side and commercial aircraft. And that is by far the most Boeing has done so far in terms of accountability. For the longest time, really, nobody had been held accountable. Certainly shouldn't be any surprise to see more of that going forward as more information emerges.
Here now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Seth, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
It's Here and Now, and we are covering Brexit from London this week, but we're joined now by two people who cover it all week, every week, on the popular BBC Brexit Cast podcast. Joining us now are Chris Mason and Adam Fleming, hosts of the podcast. Guys, welcome.
Hello.
Thank you.
And Chris, you're in London, mm-hmm. and Adam, you are in Brussels, where the EU is based, and you are based. I want to get a little of the news out of the way, because there's so much happening this week. But let me ask you, Chris, first, will an election finally bring some clarity to what the country wants on Brexit?
I'm going to use one of my favourite Brexit words here, Jeremy, which is maybe, because it entirely depends on the outcome of the election. I think if there is a clear victory by a single party, and in all likelihood that would either be the Conservatives who are currently in government or Labour who are the main party of opposition, because they are the two hulking giants of British politics. If either of them win an overall majority, finding an overall majority at Westminster in recent years has not been easy for either of those parties, then we will have at least a vision as to what is likely to happen immediately after the election. If it's the Conservatives and it's Boris Johnson, then he's got his Brexit deal with Brussels that he's not been able to find enough support for in the House of Commons up to now. And that comes back in and he has a majority for it. He gets it through. He goes to Brussels. It's all signed off. The UK leaves the European Union at the end of January. And then the UK enters a transition period whilst it negotiates the long-term relationship. If Labour win an election with an overall majority, we know that they want to negotiate what they see as a better Brexit deal with an emphasis on workers' rights and the customs union, one of the economic projects of the European Union the Conservatives have advocated leaving, and then putting that deal alongside Remain to a referendum, which presumably would take place in the middle of next year. Of course, what we don't know is if that were to happen, what the outcome of that referendum would be. be. Well, so they're the two big things that could happen. Of course, it may be that neither party wins overall and things are even more complicated.
And we also know that referendums make things really simple because everybody can figure out exactly what the country wanted when they voted. Let me ask you, Adam, as you watch this from Brussels, how are the other countries in the EU watching everything that's going on right now in the UK? Do they feel that they have any control left over what happens with Brexit?
Oh, they actually want to be in a situation where they have as little impact on the domestic situation in the UK as possible. And that was one of the reasons that it took them such a long time over the last couple of days to make their last big decision, which was about extending the deadline to the Brexit process, which was the 31st of October and is now the 31st of January. They wanted to take a how do we do as little as possible to interfere here kind of role. They would love if there was a general election that had a decisive result that speeded the Brexit deal on its way to being approved in the British Parliament. If you get a result that is a different kind of government that wants to renegotiate the deal, well, that's slightly less palatable and causes slightly more problems. But they are just worried that maybe you end up with a similar result where there's the same stalemate and this goes on. And they're also worried about just practical things like, actually, what if the election doesn't for some reason end up happening when it's meant to and you end up having to have it next year, which would mean you'd need to extend the deadline again.
So let's back up a little bit because you have to cover this, as we said, all week, every week. I noticed that there's a channel here in the UK on Sky News that has everything but Brexit for people who don't want to hear about it at all. How do you get people to care about this topic and keep coming back to your podcast?
You know what? I think the curiosity with this topic, because yes, it is the sort of thing where we're talking about it all the time. And I do think that there might be a reckoning for people like Adam and I at some stage where, you know, the country decides that after hearing us nonstop for years on end, that we are banished from the airwaves for at least a decade. But I think, curiously, people can be simultaneously bored and fascinated by Brexit. You know, the same person holding both sentiments at the same time, because I think people get, whatever their view about Brexit, people get the jeopardy of it, the scale of what is what this is all about. But at the same time, we're all human, and you wake up sometimes and turn on your phone or the radio and the telly and think, oh, blimey, they're still talking about this. And of course, because this process is, to put it mildly, involved, quite often the pace at which things change is very, very slow. Granted, in recent weeks there's been quite a lot of change quite quickly, but for a lot of these last three and a bit years, you know, the pace has been very slow, but the headlines have been ever-present.
Well, actually, that brings me to another question, which is, do you think that now, because many people are so frustrated with the process and they just want to get it done, get it over with, whatever happens, do you think that the media, and I'll put this to you, Adam, do you think the media are doing a good job in covering this in a way that doesn't, I saw it just compared to coverage of the Iraq war recently, that the idea that we've got to get it over with may force people into a situation that they don't actually want or wouldn't be good for anybody?
Fantastic. We're doing a fantastic job. Next question. We've got to be careful with that, because actually one of the sides in this debate is the government led by Boris Johnson, whose big pitch is that people are sick of Brexit, so let's get a move on. So if we were to start just unconsciously, subconsciously echoing that view, then we're kind of taking a side, and it's our job to be completely, completely impartial, because there are plenty of people making the argument that actually more time is needed to scrutinise the deal that's been done, and that there are people who still want to overturn the result of the referendum, and for the UK to remain in the EU. So we have to be very careful to reflect all those different bits of opinion and, oh, this is taking such a long time, let's just get it over with. While that might be a quite powerful sort of meme, and you might meet lots of people who feel that way about the process, that doesn't mean that that is the only bit of the argument that we have to convey.
Do you think that you have figured out exactly what Boris Johnson wants? If he could wave a magic wand and have the Brexit result, does he want a no-deal Brexit? Does he want a deal Brexit? Or does he not want Brexit at all? I mean, can you tell?
I think we've got to the point in this debate, actually, where things are hiding in plain sight, where people are saying what they believe, that there isn't any sort of smoke and mirrors, or not as much as there often is in political discussion. I think Boris Johnson always wanted a deal. I think he would, you know, was clearly pleased to get a deal and will say plenty in the forthcoming general election campaign about how he achieved a new deal when plenty of people said it wouldn't be possible to reopen the withdrawal agreement and all that kind of stuff. I think his instinct and the instinct of most of those around him is that a deal is better than no deal. And he'll be able to argue in the election campaign that he's got a deal, but he just needs a majority in order to enact it. So I think in that sense, we kind of know where his instincts lie.
Adam, would Brexit actually change anything for you if it happened, since you are a Brit living in another EU country?
Well, it depends what Brexit we get. If there was a no-deal Brexit and the UK did leave without a deal, we would then be into the contingency measures that each EU country have put in place. Brussels is in Belgium. In Belgium, British citizens can carry on exactly how they are until December 2020, so around about this time next year. Then the Belgian government would have to take a view about what my permanent status would be. If there is a deal, if it goes through, there'll be what's known as the transition period, or what the UK government calls the implementation phase, where all our rights would stay the same, actually until about the same time as if there was no deal, but that could be extended for a couple of years. And then we're into the period of negotiations over the future relationship economically and everything else that deals with the relationship between the UK and the EU, and the status of UK citizens in EU countries in the longer term would become an issue. But another part of the deal is maintaining our status for a good few years after the end of the transition period. So if there is a deal, I don't have to worry about my status here for quite a few years
yet. Let me just finally ask each of you, what do you think you will cover when Brexit is over?
I'm going to sleep for a long time and then claim the entire 2030s back in lieu for all the extra work I feel like I've done in the last 5 years.
For me, I think my job will carry on quite similarly, because there's going to be this massive negotiation for the permanent future relationship on trade, security, you name it. Everything where the UK and the EU have a relationship now will have to be put on a new footing. And that will take, well, the government thinks it could take a few months, but lots of people here in Brussels think it could take 5 years maybe. So I have a feeling I'll be looking at lots of the same sort of stuff, but just through a slightly different kind of telescope. And I think it might be potentially a bit less fraught, because someone told me it's going to be more boring.
Well, I want to thank both of you for joining us, and also for making Brexit more fascinating for me. I'm fascinated by it to begin with, but I do love listening to your podcast when I'm walking my dog in the morning. Brexit Cast podcast is what it's called. Adam Fleming and Chris Mason of the BBC, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for having us.
And you can send me your questions about Brexit on Twitter at Jeremy Hobson, and I will bring them in person to Rob Watson and Frank Langfitt later this week. It's Here and Now.
Can you imagine coming to the U.S. seeking asylum, escaping from violence and gang members in your home country, and discovering that your case may depend on your teeth? That's what happened when 17-year-old Jose Antonio Hernandez Vasquez came from Guatemala to the U.S. border, where he should have been sheltered with other children and given access to lawyers to make his case for asylum. Instead, his lawyers say, because of a controversial practice called forensic odontology, he was given a dental exam, which border agents wrongly read as saying he was an adult, and he was sent to jail. Ultimately, the Guatemalan consulate found his birth certificate proving his age, but it may be too late. While in jail, he had to represent himself in a deportation hearing and is now appealing a deportation order. And he's far from alone. So what is this dental procedure? Elizabeth Diganji is an associate professor of anthropology specializing in teeth at Binghamton University in New York. She joins us now. And Dr. Diganji, so what is forensic odontology?
So forensic odontology is kind of a fancy way of saying forensic dentistry. It's the application of dental knowledge for medical legal purposes. So probably the most common thing that your listeners are going to be familiar with is doing a positive identification of somebody who has passed away by comparing x-rays from when they visited the dentist when they were still alive with x-rays after they passed away.
Let's back up, because there are people who say that this whole, you know, procedure, looking at teeth to determine someone's age, is fake science. So what would you say the questions are?
The problem is with anyone who presents themselves as being a minor, and who then there is a question about whether or not they are 18. Any one of those individuals is probably going to be somewhere between 16 to 21. So anyone who might look like they're 18, the only tooth that's available to evaluate in that stage of life, so your mid-adolescence to your early adulthood, is going to be your wisdom tooth or the third molar. And the wisdom tooth is the most variable tooth in the entire mouth. Because of that irregularity and the variation in that tooth in and of itself, there's a very wide spread of completion in terms of the years when it's actually going to be finished. And so while it's unusual, sometimes you can have it complete in people who are as young as in their early teens. Sometimes you can have it not complete in people until they are in their early 20s. And that's really the problem with using it to determine whether or not somebody is 18.
Why else would somebody's teeth maybe not reflect their age?
So this is actually a really interesting question. So, and it's because of the difference between your chronological age, or the number of years that have passed since you were born, and your biological age, which is the particular state of growth or development or degeneration that your body happens to be in. And there's not a one-to-one relationship between those two. And the reason is because of your individual genetics, because of environmental variables that maybe you have been exposed to that others have not been exposed to, even something like your level of psychosocial stress. All of those things are going to impact how close that relationship is between your biological age and your chronological age. And for that reason, we can't ever say with 100% certainty that somebody is or is not 18 based on that third molar in particular.
And you probably know that ICE officials say that they have hundreds, thousands of cases of fraud on the part of migrants who are seeking asylum. And some are of those are adults who claim to be children. So what are you saying? Do you think that this dental exam should be thrown out altogether or used in combination with something else? I mean, what are you saying?
So I'm not willing to go as far as to say that I think that age estimation from bones and teeth should be thrown out altogether. I think that there are a lot of things that can be done for estimation of age. And the important thing is, as I just said, we can never pinpoint with 100% certainty if somebody is a particular age. What we are doing is we are estimating a range of ages, and we have to be able to, or we have to be reporting in our in that official report any issues so that the decision maker can come to an informed decision. And that's also something that's not happening right now.
In fact, the 2008 Trafficking Victims Reauthorization and Protection Act prevents ICE from relying exclusively on forensic odontology, but there's a lot of evidence that they're doing that. I mean, a lot of the actual people doing the exam are saying they're doing it in part to help these kids, you know, to try to confirm their young age. But do you suggest that people may be stopped until they can be assured that there will be other information looked at as well?
To be honest, in my experience of the cases that I've been privy to, the last thing the dental report has done is helped the children. If anything, it's had very serious punitive consequences for the children. In some cases, some of those children may have been deported. And so, yeah, I think there are some ethical questions that the forensic odontologists doing this work have to seriously consider before they continue working for ICE.
Elizabeth DeGangi, Associate Professor of Anthropology at Binghamton University in New York. Dr. DeGangi, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.